Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Hello. This is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, I'm here with two members of the team from Dig In, a fast casual restaurant group based in New York, Taylor Lanzett, the Director of Supply and Sustainability, and Larry C., the Farm Manager. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And right before the show, I learned something that I didn't know, which is really fun, which is that, Taylor, you actually used to host a show on HRN.
Yeah, Eating Matters, all about food policy and how it impacts your everyday life.
So that's really cool. You're like part of the Heritage Radio family.
100%.
And that show is still on, hosted by Jenna Liu.
Yeah.
So if you've never listened, definitely check that out. So happy to have you back. So I think that where we should start is just in case people don't know what Dig In is, if, you know, they're not in New York, they've never gotten to go in and eat. Can you give us a little background on when it started, the kind of food you serve, how many locations there are, sort of like the big picture? What is Dig In?
Dig In started in 2011 and combined fine and the best parts of fine dining with fast casual. And so we created our new category called Fine Fast. And our focus is on seasonal American food. So we work directly with producers locally and build menus that support seasonal and regional farms.
And how many locations are you at right now?
We have 26 locations. Three in Boston and the rest are in New York City.
Wow. And the Boston locations came fairly recently, yeah?
I think about 2 years ago.
Okay. So that was like probably a big deal branching outside of...
Second market, and yeah. We'll be opening up our third market very soon.
Oh, can you tell us where, or is it top secret?
Can't tell you yet.
Got it. you know, you mentioned in that description that you source from local farms. So that's kind of one of your differentiators in this realm, right?
Yeah, we are really focused on working with producers directly, and that manifests in a myriad of ways. We plan at the beginning of the season. So this past month, and from February and March, we planned over 3.5 million pounds of food with farmers who are crop planning for us, building their farm plans around products that we're looking to source from them. We also intentionally work with farmers who are working on transitioning to organic or small scale or looking to scale their business. And alongside of our own farm, Larry helps us find new farm partners and really legitimize the work that we're doing in the space.
Right. And with 3.5 million pounds, how does that... like what percentage of the food that you're serving is that? Like how does that number compare to the pounds of food that you're using?
So last year over half of the pounds of vegetables that we served were sourced locally, and over three quarters were sourced direct from partners that could call me up during this podcast and just want to chat and catch up.
That happens a lot. You're on the phone with farmers a lot, I'm sure. Not just Larry, right?
Larry takes up the most time. But,
And I want to get into that. I want to really talk about your day-to-day and how you work with farmers. But Larry, why don't you give us some context on what the farm itself looks like?
So we started Digging Farm 2 years ago. We're moving into our third season now.
Okay.
We grow about 12 to 14, really depends on, how you count it. 12 to 14 acres of mixed vegetables in Chester, New York, which is in southern Orange County, about hour 15 north of the city from Midtown.
It's also, fun fact, where I grew up.
In Chester? Really?
So I grew up in Warwick, which is right next to Chester.
Right next door. Amazing.
And so I spent, my entire childhood there. Chester was... I was in Chester a lot. My high school best friend's boyfriend worked at the pizzeria there, so...
No way. The one in the village?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a cute little town. Oh, we love going to that pizza place. Yeah.
What about Allen's Falafel?
And then Allen's Falafel.
That did not exist. Oh. I've heard that it's really good. Now when I go visit my family, everyone talks about it.
We eat a lot of Allen's on the farm.
But yeah, it's such a cool agricultural region because of the black dirt.
Yeah, the black dirt. So we grow in the black dirt, which... for our listeners who don't know what we mean by the black dirt, it is muck soil. So what it is essentially about 3,000 acres of wetland that was drained out in the early 20th century. And so if you kind of think about that, the concept of draining 3,000 acres of wetland today is unfathomable.
Yeah.
And so this region is really unique because it's super fertile soil. The soil is jet black. I remember when Taylor and I first visited the site that we're on, I didn't want to walk into it because when you're on a farm, normally you see anything that dark, it's usually cow poop. Huh. And so all of the alarms are going off in my head. It was like, don't touch this, don't touch this. And eventually it was like, oh no, this is just
That's
soil.
It's just the dirt, yeah.
And so we're really lucky to be there. I think it's it's the largest stretch of black dirt, of muck soil in the country outside the Everglades. And it'll always be that way again because, a project of this scale would never, ever happen again. Mm. And, we're really lucky to be there. It's super fertile. We never actually have to push any compost onto the ground. It has all the fertility that we need just to begin with at a baseline. On a normal organic farm, the organic matter, which is the measure of carbon and general soil health, usually around 3 to 5% in, in a standard farm. On a really high performing farm, you're looking at 10 to 15%. Here, our baseline is somewhere between 30 to 50%.
Oh my gosh.
So it's essentially like growing in compost itself, and our plants grow really fast. They grow really well, but on the flip side, right? If our plants grow well, the weeds grow even faster. So in organic production, the main challenge has always been weeds, and we have more than enough at our farm to serve the region. But in any case, so we do 12 to 14 there. The primary focus of our farm is education. It's education for our chefs who come visit, every other week during the summer. They come, they learn about farming. They learn about the work that it takes to grow food and, learn some of the science behind it. And, we make it fun and, they help us out on the farm a little bit. And, this way our intention is that when our chefs come out and they participate in the harvest and they do work on the farm, when they see those vegetables again in the restaurant, they're going to cook it with more soul. They're not going to waste the food. They're going to understand where it's coming from and, the amount of labor and passion that was put into it at its start. And they should be expected to put that same amount of labor and passion in it when they're cooking it.
Right.
And, we think it's a really powerful thing. Everyone, all of our chefs, they want to come out to the farm. Whenever I go into any of our dig-ins, they're like, Larry, when are we going to the farm? When are we going to the farm?
There's a really amazing emotional connection, right? When any chef or someone who works in food walks onto a farm and it's the moment when you harvest a cherry tomato and it bursts in your mouth and the sun's shining on you and you're sinking in the black dirt. And so for a lot of our team members who are chefs in training or learning what that culinary experience could look like, sometimes it's their first experience on a farm and the amount of information that they're taking in, plus the emotional connection, is just really rewarding.
And I think it's important, too, to recognize that when we say chefs, we talk about every team member in our restaurants, right? We consider every person who works at Dig In a chef or a chef in training. You know, that's where we eventually want them to become. So when we say chefs, we mean everybody at our restaurants, and they all come out. Yeah, they have a grand old time there. You know, they get some Allens, you know, do some field work. And then, you know, we also, in on the other side of that too, is, you know, we run a farmer training program as well. And so every year we bring on a new crew. The people that we hire people with very little experience in the field, right? Hmm. You know, 1 year at the most, maybe 2 years. And so, you know, we pay above the industry average. We pay overtime, on our farm, which is, and I'm not sure if your listeners know this, but is not required for farms to pay overtime. So it's a pretty good deal, you know, for our crew. And, you know, we want them to, you know, we want to bring a new crew in every year because we want this to be a training place where young people come in and they get the skills that they need to move on to any other farm and become a manager there or to start their own farm. You know, I call this like kind of a crash course in agriculture because, you know, we just had our crew start on Monday, and on Tuesday they're already on a tractor tilling a field.
Wow.
You know, we really want them to have the tools and the confidence to work, or not just to work, but to run their own operations soon after they leave our farm. And so they take part of, you know, every single part of our farm, from greenhouse management, tractor operation, post-harvest delivery, everything. You know, everything that I do, they do as well. And we're an open book. You know, they see, you know, all of our budgets. They see all of our equipment purchases, you know, so that they have an actual well-rounded view of what it takes to run a farm.
Right.
And not just that, but we're linking the Dig In restaurant group and the supply team to them as well. So if they have questions about what it looks like to supply for a restaurant of our size, how to work with buyers, the differences between wholesale and retail, the experience is really well-rounded.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so then what about the food that you're growing? So the produce, does it end up on plates at Dig In, in bowls, I think you mostly have?
Yeah, so we, our farm, we grow, you know, it's a standard, but it's a mixed vegetable farm, and we grow all the vegetables that, you know, you might see on any other farm, right? I like to call it a hybrid CSA wholesale model, where we grow a little bit of everything and a lot of a few things. We grow a lot of cucumbers, we grow a lot of tomatoes, we grew a lot of eggplant last year, not going to grow quite as much this year, and we grow a lot of chili peppers. And so we kind of think of those as the cornerstones of our operation, which is where, you know, our budget is built.
Okay.
And everything else is mostly for our crew to understand, like, how do you grow these things, right?
Okay.
You know, Dig In buys in so much broccoli from our partner farms in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, that doesn't necessarily make sense for me to grow any broccoli at all. But,
got it.
You know, it would, you know, we'd be a poor training operation if our farmers didn't know how to grow broccoli, right?
Mm.
So we grow, you know, we want our team to experience every single vegetable that they might see on any other farm.
Right.
And sorry. And yes, everything that we grow does go to our restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, we understand that this is a fairly unique position that our farm is in that it is, you know, funded by Dig In, and that, you know, we have certain advantages in the industry, and we want to be a good neighbor, and we want to be a good force in agriculture. So we don't want to go to a farmer's market and compete with other, you know, young farmers or other family farmers. You know, we don't want to run a CSA because there are already so many CSAs in our area.
Right.
So our intention is that we try to grow things that will take Dig In's reliance on supply outside of our region and focus it into New York again.
Got it. Yeah, and I mean, it's... Like, how much do you think is actually going from the farm to Dig In? Like, do you have any idea of, like, how many pounds of produce you're producing there?
Yeah. So last year, probably close to 80,000 pounds went to Dig In, and this year we're hoping for over 100,000.
Yeah. I think 150.
150.
You know, we like to challenge ourselves here.
Yeah.
But on a... sort of for context, last year in total, Dig In bought 6 million pounds of vegetables. So
right. It's a small proportion.
It's a small portion, yeah. But what really sticks is that for so many, there's such variety in it.
Mm.
And a lot of the produce that's not core to our menu will be the inspiration for our specials program.
Got it.
So you could walk into a dig and sort of have a surprise and delight experience where Lair was growing a small amount of shiso and it ends up at your dig-in.
Mm.
Yeah, so a lot of the specials that you'll see at our restaurants will come from the farm. And then there are certain items, too, that come directly from our supply. So, for example, last year, we grew all the basil for our pesto throughout the summer. Mm. So all the pesto in our restaurants were from our farm. So we'll kind of pick and choose certain items that we say that this is reasonable for a farm of our size to grow, right? Like, we could never supply, you know, all the kale or all the broccoli that Diggin produces.
I'm
but
glad,
there are certain
I'm
items
glad
that
everyone's
we can.
Eating so much broccoli. That's
great news for the health of New Yorkers.
Broccoli and sweet potatoes.
Huh. I mean, that's great.
You know, I think what's really cool is that, you know, since we started this farm, you know, we have our own, you know, I always like to say that, you know, we farm in the way of our mentors and we kind of add on and we, you know, we grow a little bit. But it's always, we all have certain styles, right? And as Taylor knows, you know, I have a certain style of farming and I have a certain style of pack out and I have a certain, you know, selection of varieties that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the tomatoes that we get in normally through our suppliers are a certain set. You know, we have a contract out and, you know, they deliver the same thing every week.
Right.
For us, you know, we grow a whole different, you know, way different, like a larger variety and all these weird different shapes. And then we send those to our restaurants too, right?
Mm.
And so this forces our chefs to be more agile, right? To adapt to, like, you know, normally, you know, before we had this farm, right? It would just be the same tomatoes every week and,
yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. But now, you know, all of a sudden, boom, here's a case of tomatoes where you've never seen it before. And like, what are you going to do with it?
Mm.
And, you know, you're not going to be able to cut these the same way that you normally cut them, right? So it makes our chefs think a little bit more and think outside the box that they've always been trained in here at Dig In to expect new vegetables, to expect new ways of cooking, and to learn and to grow.
Right.
And I think that's a really powerful and important thing.
Yeah, and kind of unexpected at a restaurant like Dig In, like where you're, you know, going for lunch or, you know, you might not expect like have this really interesting special on the menu at a similar, you know, another restaurant of that kind. Okay, so we've got Larry is growing these amazing vegetables in Orange County. And then Taylor, you're working with all these other farmers all over the region. This inevitably involves a lot of logistics.
Love logistics.
So, I mean, me too, which is why I'm asking you about this. But, you know, I mean, I think most, especially like places in the fast casual space, when you have a lot of locations of a restaurant, it's easier to buy from Sysco or Baldor because you can place an order and they show up with everything and you don't have to deal with that, right? So what are some of the challenges that you face in terms of making this work?
Yeah. So we have a central distribution center in the Bronx that allows us to be really agile and nimble, similar to how Larry was explaining our chefs and our restaurants operate. And what this allows us to do is receive orders as small as 10 cases from partners. So some partners who maybe just want to send us 10 cases a week of kale and for them, that's scale. We work with them to do that. So over the course of a given season, we could be receiving kale from up to 20 different partners.
Mm.
With that, obviously, creates some challenges. Farmers definitely have a bad rep for not being great communicators.
They're busy.
They're all busy. We're all busy. But there's definitely a large... It's just a matter of putting the puzzle together. So
yeah.
Figuring out when product is coming in, and especially if we're trying to feature that particular farm's product, it's a lot of dates and moving around deliveries, and half of the cost sometimes can be figuring out getting it into the city and just the cost of distribution. So our main focus is never allowing the cost of moving food to take away from the farmer either making money or allowing them to participate in the program.
Mm.
So it's always about taking away any barrier for entry, and we work with growers to do that. And sometimes it's logistics, sometimes it's packing, sometimes it's pack size. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, and I would imagine that helps a farmer a lot to be able to just drop off at that distribution point for all of the restaurants in New York rather than having to
exactly.
have someone drive around to each one.
Exactly.
And, yeah, that would take forever, especially in the city. I can't, yeah.
Yeah, I think if I asked our farmers to deliver to 27 restaurants, might be a little bit more challenging of a conversation to have.
Right.
I would not do it. I can just say that
first. Right
now.
Larry would not do it.
I mean, you know, I was talking to, you know, I met a new grower this morning at Union Square. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, bringing him on and, you know, buying carrots from him. And I told him, you know, we have a single distribution point in Hunts Point in the Bronx that you can deliver to. And he was like, amazing.
Yeah.
And he was like, that is a huge selling point for us to work with you all because... you know, who wants to drive to Manhattan?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, no one wants to drive Manhattan. A big truck? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And at a larger scale, it just really allows us to have full ownership of our supply chain, which is our goal at DIG. We want to be able to know every point at which it comes to us and we can trust what we're sending out to our restaurants, and also have really good conversations and feedback opportunities with our suppliers. So, hey, you know what? Next time, just send the kale loose. Don't even bother bunching it. Does this save you time on the labor? Can you maybe be quicker when you're harvesting? All of these things, being able to control the whole supply chain allows us to get even better at what we're doing.
Mm.
And I think, too, you know, I think that's a great strength of us having our own farm, right? Because at the end of each season, I can sit down with Taylor and we can talk about what are the challenges of what we've grown this year. You know, what can we, you know, why did this turn out this way? You know, why should you be packing this way? And so, you know, because I work with Taylor, right? We can sit down and have this conversation. We can have this conversation over a couple of days, over, you know, for as long as it is necessary, and we can get that information. Whereas any other farmer is like, I don't have time to just like sit down with you and take a whole week to discuss, you know, what happened in the season. But I can do that with Taylor, and that's information that helps us with our partners too, and, you know, allows us to grow a closer bond to all of our other farmers.
Yeah, absolutely. And what one thing I'm curious about too is today is such a beautiful day. I was thinking about this on the way over. I'm like, oh, it's finally spring. It's so nice out. What do you do in the winter? I mean, we are not in a region where you can source locally year-round, right? So how do you manage that?
Yeah, great question.
you're like, April, it's the bane of my existence.
I actually think April is the hardest month to source food. It's brutal. But there are we have a pretty strong and robust local program in the winter as well. And a lot of that is because agriculture and has helped us in storage crops. So our winter menu is made up of butternut squash and apples and beets and carrots. Actually, a lot of the winter squashes. But this allows us to really still celebrate local food and guarantee that producers are making money in December and January and March. And we plan with them such that we can, they can store that for us, or we can figure out storage opportunities that allow us to keep having a weekly income that we provide for them.
Right.
The other thing is, we definitely, you know, not every crop has a strong shelf life, so we'll move down south before we move west, and that has just allowed us to celebrate more of the Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina farmers. That are a part of the regional food system and prevent us from going to California.
Got it. Do you source from any of the indoor farms around New York too, like Greens or?
We have a few partnerships with Gotham Greens, Aero Farms, Bowery Farms, and we love to celebrate them, especially in the winter.
Right.
And in the summer, we definitely... those relationships are valuable, and we offer more of a responsive nature. So they'll say, hey, we have a ton of extra product that we'd love to move, or hey, this product was slightly damaged or what we'd call imperfect. Can you help us? And we play that role just because we do lean towards supporting outdoor soil-driven agriculture in the summer.
Interesting. All right, so we need to take a quick break. We will... be back. I want to, after the break, maybe get a little into just the value of the way you do things and local sourcing. And we'll kind of, I was going to say, we'll dig into that. Oh my God. All right. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise and affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Serchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Hey there, seems like you like podcasts. My name is Eli Sussman. I'm a chef and restaurant owner, and I've got a great podcast right here on Heritage Radio Network called The Line. On my show, I interview chefs and restaurateurs about the trajectory of their career. It's a one-on-one conversation where we talk about where it all started, to where they are cooking now, and everything in between. You can find The Line everywhere you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. You're listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Taylor and Larry from Dig In, and we've been talking about all of them, the ways that they grow and source the food for the many restaurants. So we've been talking a lot about logistics and how this all works. Obviously, both of you believe strongly in sourcing from local farms, especially given, you know, we talked about how it's harder to do things this way, right, than just working with a big distributor. I'm like super interested in talking about this question of like the value of local, and is it, you know, when there's so many other ways to qualify sourcing good food, like, you know, do you only source organic, or do you, you know, there are lots of ways people kind of qualify how they source. And I'm just curious to hear from you when someone asks you like why the focus on sourcing local food? What's your first response?
I would say that local has always been and has been a driver of how Dig sources food, but even greater than that is the direct relationships and partnerships that we have. And I think that's a little bit harder to quantify sometimes than local sourcing. But there are many anecdotes that I think speak even broader to just what it means to buy local food. Mm-hmm. For example, while we have exceptional relationships with farmers where we plan with them in advance and offer really clear opportunities to be a part of the program, we figure out logistics, right? And all this stuff, that's buying local food and buying direct is just one part. But more so, a great example would be Larry, who is working in Orange County and helping other farmers. So, hey, Larry, can I borrow the tractor? Can you help me with my fields this week? There's all these other ways in which supporting local food doesn't have to include buying, and it can include someone working at their farmer's market, working on a farm, or in Larry's case, helping other farmers succeed. And I think that positions us to care a little bit more about just the work that's being done on the relationship side to really drive what a local and then regional food system could look like.
Yeah, we, you know, on the farm, like I mentioned before, right, we want to be good partners in the space and we want to advance our industry. So for a lot of the young farmers near us, you know, the site that we're on is run by the Chester Agricultural Center. Mm-hmm. And it's an incubator type program that leases land to young farmers at a reduced rate. And so we're there, we lease land there, and there are all these other young farmers around us who don't have the money or the capital to purchase equipment. And so our, you know, our, I guess, ethical standing, or, you know, our drive here to make it easier for our partners or people who might eventually become our partners, right? These other young farmers is to make their lives easier, to help them build their businesses to be sustainable environmentally and economically. So we do tractor work for them because we have a nice tractor and we have really nice equipment, and we do it for free. And, you know, this year we, you know, last, or not this year, well, like last year we had a young lady on my crew who was very interested in starting her own farm, and she had only worked on our farm for 1 year, actually her first year farming. And, you know, I think it speaks to the strength of our training program that at the end of that, she said that she wanted to start her own farm. And so we're piloting an incubator program right now where we are giving her her farm, and her name is Kayla Holterman. Her farm is Radiance Farm.
Oh, cool.
And also, she's also from Warwick as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But so, you know, we're giving her land. We're letting her use our equipment. And, you know, I think most importantly, we're giving her a sales outlet. Because I think, you know, this is not a surprise, right? The pie for local agriculture, it doesn't really grow that quickly year on year, right? It shifts a little bit. Sometimes CSAs go more. Sometimes the farmers markets are more. Sometimes wholesale. But for the most part, it's been fairly stable. And so, you know, by giving her an outlet to sell 150 pounds of basil a week to our restaurants, we think that that's a way that we can build her business and start another young small business in our community.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll add there too, Larry, and this is something that positions us in a pretty unique space, we want to get really good at collecting knowledge and stories from season after season and get really sort of ahead of information sharing. So because of our unique position, Larry can synthesize what's happening either at our farm or from other farms in such a way where the value around local becomes even more meaningful because we can... hey, last year we tried this and it worked really well. Or if this happens, here's how to navigate it. And I think in the next couple of years, we just want to figure out the best way to be an outlet of sharing that and maybe prevent people from making the same mistakes that we've made or our partners have made.
Certainly made a lot of mistakes. you know, in a grand sense, right, I think that when we buy local, we are supporting these small businesses, right? Yeah. And Taylor knows more about our young farmer and... minority farmer portfolio than I do, but we're trying to build these small businesses so they become larger and they become bigger parts of their communities, right? Because traditionally farms have been hubs of communities, and we want more farms to pop up. We want to support more small farms to make them bigger farms and to have them, you know, become these centers where people can go to and get their fresh produce from, right? That they're not just, you know, maybe, and nothing against the people of 1 or 2 acres operations, right? But for people who want to grow bigger, we want to give them the ability to grow bigger by joining our family of farmers.
Well, and the Chester Agricultural Center is such an interesting model. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, but, you know, I think there's, what, like 7 farms on the group where you are? Something like that.
Will, yes.
You know, maybe it's...
Yeah, plus minus. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Changes every year.
But, you know, that used to be one giant onion farm that was sprayed with pesticides regularly right behind a community. And now it's all these people growing food organically, all different young farmers. It's kind of, I guess it's really an interesting model. And I like, do you think that having everyone together like that, like has that experience, do you think that it's a good model for helping young farmers get started, having people all in one place like that?
Sure. Yeah. I think, we'll tackle this a couple different ways, right?
Yeah.
For me as a farmer, it's great to be around other people.
Yeah.
Right. Cause normally it's just like me and the crew and,
right.
You know, we eventually get tired of each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to always be around other people and it's cool to see lots of different operations, right? I think it wasn't, you know, intentionally done this way, but what has happened at the CAC is that we have all these different enterprises, but we all do something a little different, right? We have someone who does CSA. We have someone who does farmers markets. We have someone who does flowers. And then, you know, we do wholesale, right? So it's cool to see different operations and to see different ways of growing. And there's a lot of knowledge sharing there because everyone, like, you know, everyone has their own way of growing. And, you know, we all share tips. And, you know, the black dirt is such a unique place that, you know, nothing really prepares you for it, right? It's so much different than upland farming that this knowledge sharing is really, really important. And the fact that there is a community around us to help support each other when, you know, when we have a bad year like last year, you know, it was one of the rainiest years, I think, in the past, like, 50 years in upstate New York. You know, we were all there to kind of just be like, well, you know, this is a bad deal, but, you know, at least we're all in this together, you know? You know, we're all kind of falling down together.
Yeah, the CAC has a, for lack of better comparison, sort of like a WeWork or collaborative working space vibe where you can share, you share resources, right?
Yeah, and that was, that's the next part I was going to get to, was that, you know, there is all this infrastructure here, right? Like, our walk-in is the size of a barn. I mean, it's huge. You know, we would never be able, I mean, you know, Diggin could build something like that, right? But, like, for a young farmer, they would never be able to build something like that, right?
Yeah.
There are all these barns, there are all these greenhouses that you can rent. And for someone who, you know, may be a little undercapitalized capitalize at the beginning of their business. It's a good deal to be able to go in there and not have to build your own greenhouse or have to build your own barn, which is, you know, the intention behind our incubator as well, that we want to give Kayla and Radiance Farm the ability to, you know, gain capital, to gain experience without having to, you know, risk everything for her. Because she's young. She's, I think, like 21, 22. Mm. And so, you know, we want her to be able to put that money into bank and then eventually build out her own infrastructure, buy her own tractor, build her own greenhouse. So essentially, the same thing what the Chester Ag Center does for all these other farmers.
Right. Yeah. One thing that I'm going to push you a little on the local thing. I was just reading this article this week, and, you know, one thing that gets thrown around a lot is, like, for people who are trying to figure out how they should eat in order to minimize environmental impact. People say, like, well, you know, it's not really better for the environment because local farmers use older trucks, and, you know, you think that it's the transportation miles are going to be a benefit, but then actually it might not be. I would just love to hear your thoughts on, like, if you're someone who wants to eat in a way that minimizes environmental impact, is local the way to go?
There's a lot of nuance there, but...
I love nuance. Let's get into it.
Local is one way that you can have a really good impact on the environment. Also, eating a diet of mostly vegetables
right. Is
also a really good way that you can have an impact on the environment, and that's something that Diggin really champions. If you were to choose never eating vegetables versus eating vegetables that were from a couple thousand miles away, I would say go with the vegetables.
Eat vegetables, yeah. That's sort of like one of the only overarching, like, diet and environmental things you can just always say, like, yes, eat vegetables.
Eat vegetables.
Don't eat sugar.
Yeah, there you go.
Better for you and the planet.
Right.
I would say that I think a lot of people need to figure out what works for them that they can stick to. Mm-hmm. So if it's going to the farmer's market and maybe learning a little bit about the tools and the practices that farmer's using that you can align with, great. Mm-hmm. But maybe someone's a little bit more inclined to learning about labor practices and immigration. And that's also a really valid way to make your choices around eating that, you know, someone might care about more than transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the most important thing is just kind of having a personal stance on it and finding producers that you can support. Another great nuance would be having organic certification versus not. And some farmers are priced out of the certification but practice even higher standards than what organic certification entails.
Right.
And then there's a great case to be made for supporting second, third, fourth generation family farms. You can choose to work with younger or beginning farmers, but keeping farmland in production and or taking it from conventional intensive and putting it into super great dynamic organic production is what a younger generation could do. So not a necessarily direct answer to that, but yeah. I think there's a lot of exciting nuance where if someone has a policy or a position that they really stand behind, there are so many producers you can find to support that.
Right.
And so, I don't want to seem like, you know, I don't want to drill down on a single point or like latch onto something that's just like one thing, right? But if we're talking about old equipment and stuff that may not be as environmentally friendly as, you know, the newer tractors, I mean, is this world a better place if every farmer was just a millionaire who decided to run their own little two-acre operation and can buy the newest equipment and can buy an electric tractor? You know, I think that, yeah, sure, you know, our young farmers, they can't afford to buy a $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 John Deere tractor.
Mm-hmm.
But does that make it... Does that disqualify them from trying to work in sync with the environment to think about the holistic health of their land?
Yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of our young farmers are pushing our industry in a better direction, and they have a lot of great ideas, and everyone's trying to grow their business and expand their businesses, but everyone's got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And these small farms, you know, they're on their way to becoming better operations, and everyone's trying to get better. You know, none of us came into this business to spray or to drive old trucks or to pollute the environment, right? We're all trying to do better. And, you know, I think too, even if say, like, this farm is, you know, 10% better, you know, mm-hmm. environmentally than another farm, well, that's 10%, you know, and if we all do 10% better, that's a huge difference, you know, and we keep moving in that direction.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell my team that, like, maybe I might not be the most sustainable farmer that you'll ever meet, right? But I think that I do 10% better than the guy that I taught was taught under.
Mm.
And if you guys do 10% better than me, and the people that you train do 10% better than you, you know, like, that's going to change the world.
Yeah, progress.
Yeah, and there's, I think for a lot of folks, the being able to either find food that they feel as if represents what their diet entails, I think is also super important. So if you're an apple eater, there's no reason why you can't buy local apples in New York year-round.
Right.
Right? Like, don't buy them from Washington State. But also, if you are Hispanic or non-white or looking for a different type of cuisine that's not represented at the farmer's market, there are tons of organizations that have specific and diverse markets that you can find food that represents your culture. And I think that's a really important piece to allow just more diversity in what people are searching for and make sure that what people are looking for is found.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that we could sort of go on a whole other conversation there. But I mean, I think everything that you said about, especially just getting young farmers started. I mean, that again could be just a whole conversation. I've had a lot of shows where we talk about just the challenges that young farmers face, and we need a lot of farmers right now, right? Like, we need to get a lot of people on land and get them farming, because farmers are just aging. And
yeah, we need more young farmers. You know, we need better ideas. We need people who are more diverse as well in our in our industry. You know, I think for a long time, and this might not be a very popular opinion, but you know, I feel very strongly that our, you know, the small, like, local farm mm-hmm. Community or industry has been built on unfair labor practices, that we've been 100%. Paying people very, you know, when I started, I got paid $600 a month to work on a farm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard work,
yeah.
You know? And I went to college, you know? Like, you know.
Right.
But
right, and we're talking about farmers. We're not even talking about farm workers that maybe aren't the farm owners,
exactly,
that are all minority immigrants, that,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. And so I, you know, a lot of the people who were able to make things work come from you know, privileged backgrounds,
uh-huh.
That come from places that, you know that are predominantly white, that are predominantly middle to upper middle class,
right.
And it has really skewed our industry towards, you know, towards this class of people, mm-hmm. And so, you know, couple of years ago, I had someone come up to me, and Taylor, I just told you the story in the
yeah.
car, you know, come up to me at a conference, and she was like, "Are you Larry, the farmer from Dig In?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "I am. How did you know?"
This happens, she was all
the, like, celebrity.
Well, no, but she was like, you know, I heard Dig In hired an Asian farmer, so I just assumed it was you, because you're the only Asian farmer
God.
Here, you know? And I mean, it's kind of cool for me, but right. you know, it doesn't speak,
like,
well,
oh,
to our industry,
yeah.
right?
Oh,
that
God.
We don't have these many people,
right.
This many people, and you know, I think for you know, how do we serve our underrepresented communities, right?
Yeah,
you can't go into an Asian community and try to sell pesto basil,
right?
You know, like, we're not going to touch that. You know, you have to understand these communities that you want to serve, and our industry as a whole does not serve our minority communities.
Hmm.
And that's why we need to bring in more minorities. We need to figure out a way that, and this is, you know, a very grand problem, right? On a macro scale, that this is a problem with
yeah.
agriculture. How do we raise the incomes of our farmers so that we can have righteous wages for all of our employees? Because not everyone can afford to pay their employees like they can afford to pay.
Right.
Again, you know, we realize that we are in a privileged position to be able to pay our employees like this, but how do we, you know, create an agriculture system that is, you know, judicious and fair to all the people who work here, you know, to all of our farm workers in California, you know, I mean, we don't have to get too deep into
right.
that whole thing, right? But, like, how do we raise their wages? How do we, not raise their standing in society, but, you know, shine a light on this portion of our industry and say, this is why your food is this cheap, is because these working conditions are like this.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, this is becoming a 3-part series.
Oh, my God. This is, like, I love these topics.
The last thing I'll say to that point, Larry, is all the work that Larry's doing to increase access to learning how to farm and create opportunities for people who otherwise might not have access to it, we are also doing that at the Dig In supply chain more broadly. Mm. So we set goals for ourselves and really intentionally seek out marginalized women, people of color, queer, immigrant farmers that we can spend money with. We want to support them and use our purchasing power for good.
Right. Well, we have to wrap up, and I think that is a great place to end. thank you both for being here. This was a really, really interesting conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
My first podcast.
Amazing.
Or radio show, I suppose.
It's both. Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. And don't forget to support independent food radio by visiting heritageradionetwork.com and clicking on the beating heart. See you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.